classical, classic, classy. What do these words conjure for you? They're pretty loaded terms. They can imply quality, longevity, things that have stood the test of time. They can also imply snobbery or discrimination, a way that some claim to be better than others. In architecture, the meaning of classical is more specific, but can still be hard to pin down. It refers, at one level, to the architectural style of ancient Greece and Rome, and the later interpretations of that architecture in periods like the Renaissance. The forms associated with that style are familiar to any student of architectural history: columns, capitals, entablatures, pediments, the so-called orders of architecture, Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian, and the accompanying ornamental detail. Its familiar forms are governed by ideas, principles, aspirations that inform their use and give them meaning. Classical architecture has a soul as well as a body. To drill down more deeply into these more abstract qualities of classical architecture, I spoke to a distinguished scholar who has spent much of his career pondering classicism in architecture and what its underlying values might be. Professor Pierre Dupré is Professor Emeritus and Queen's Research Chair at Queen's University in Kingston, and Adjunct Research Professor in our very own History and Theory of Architecture program at Carleton University. His books include Palladio in Print, Ah Wilderness, Resort Architecture in the Thousand Islands, Hawksmoor's London Churches, The Villas of Pliny from Antiquity to Posterity, John Soane, The Making of an Architect, John Soane's Architectural Education, and most recently, Francesco Ignazio Lazzari's Descrizione della Villa Pliniana. He is also the creator of the website Architecture in the Classical Tradition, a pioneering online textbook of the history of architecture which my students still use nearly 20 years after its creation. I've posted a link to his site on this page. Pierre and I spoke at his home near Kingston, Ontario. I started by asking him about the idea of classicism in architecture, the baggage the word carries, and the inadequacy of reducing it to a list of features like columns and cornices.
I think part of the problem with the word classicism is that, of course, it comes with a certain amount of baggage, and that baggage has to do with the word classic, which, as anybody knows, they just go to online or in a dictionary or whatever, find out that, you know, it goes back to ancient Greece and Rome. It also has connotations of something that is classy, and many of us sort of resist that idea, you know, and I think rightly so, that it's sort of exclusionary in some way or other, that there are those people that are classy and others that aren't. And then, yes, it comes down to being sort of like a recipe book. People say, well, you know, you've got to have a column, it's got to be Ionic or Doric, and it comes with this, that, and the other thing. That's the cornice, and this is the regular, and it gets more and more and more detailed. I think the difficulty there is that it just begins to become a little bit like a cookbook. A pinch of regular, a dose of cornice, a foot or two of, and I do mean foot, of such and such a molding will be the answer. And it's not. It's clearly not that. And so I object to the idea that just by putting those things together, we can come to a full picture.
So if classical architecture isn't just about certain easily identified forms, like Doric capitals or temple facades, what else is it? According to Pierre Dupré, it has always been guided by an underlying ethos that's grounded in a fundamental human need for equilibrium, balance, and moderation.
So what the ancient Greeks and the Romans did, I think, they realized that what would appeal to those innermost sensations and responses that we all carry with us would be something that is not too big, not too small, not too skinny, not too fat. right in the equilibrium, the balance. And that's why some of them have said, you know, things like humankind is the measure of all things. That's one of the great statements of the ancient world. And furthermore, this notion of moderation, used that word earlier on. If moderation is the father, so Democritus tells us, and that's 5th century before the Common Era, if, as Democritus says, moderation is the father, then order is the greatest child. So there's this sense of paternity. If you have a moderate outlook on life, by which I mean your actions, your buildings, everything that you do, the crafts that you create with your hands, that will lead to the orderly life in art, in politics, in speech, in our demeanor towards one another, society as a whole. That's the kind of thing that glues us all together. And I think many of us realize that that's true, that that transcends a lot of cultures, that transcends languages, transcends many, many things. So I think that that notion of balance, that notion of equilibrium, of things that are the mean between the extremes, as it's just the title of one of my presentations in architecture in the classical tradition, that notion that the not too big and the not too small, the thing that's in between those extremes, is what you ought, insofar as possible, to aim towards. That could be true of any number of things: music, literature, mathematics, early geometry, which does indeed go back to the ancient Greeks, as many things do. But it's not restricted to that. I think they just simply were codifying, writing down what their forebearers for many, many centuries before had understood at some much more basic level, that we feel and respond to structures that give us a sense of being, I might say, well proportioned. By well proportioned, I mean proportioned with respect to us as people, things that we go into, things we look at from the outside, that we recognize as being satisfying, if I can use that word, and that's a very general term, but somehow satisfies our need for, well, I guess I could say, it's a bit of a loaded term, beauty with a capital B in our lives. I mean, we all strive to, in one way or another, have some of that in our lives. And that's, of course, where architecture really begins to sing. The classical interpreted in that way as being something that is, as I said, well proportioned to us, makes a song. It makes a song that we all want to sing. We want to sing along with that song. And it doesn't need to be a great, monumental building somewhere. It doesn't need to be a cathedral. It doesn't need to be a temple. It could be the house across the street from you. It just sings.
With identifying classical architecture by just its forms, its body, and not its soul, is that it can create a debased, superficial architecture that can become a mere status symbol, an architectural sneer of the powerful toward the powerless, or the rich toward the poor.
A lot of people have tapped into the orders of architecture on a very superficial level. And the orders of architecture, and even to some extent this notion of balance and moderation, for them become kind of rather superficial or hollow symbols for authority. And that's another sense in which I come back to what I talked about right at the very beginning. I said something about one of our problems with the word classicism is that it's embedded in this notion of class, of classy, of people who are better and people who are not so good. Architecture can be distorted in this way. There have been instances in which these trappings that you refer to aren't purely and simply that. They're nothing more than trappings. They're empty symbols, but without the underlying belief in the importance of this to elevate our spirits without subjugating us in some way, politically or otherwise, not influencing us, not trying to overawe us towards one belief or another belief, whatever it might be. And that's when it becomes a little bit dangerous. And many people have used that as a stick with which to beat the classical tradition in architecture. And there's some sense in which they're correct, that it's been misused, it's been distorted.
More fundamentally, according to Pierre, architecture that stays true to the classical tradition is an architecture that is sensitive and responsive to how the human body experiences space. It's an architecture that communicates to us in terms that our bodies can understand and defines itself relative to our bodies. That's why, for millennia, we measured its dimensions in units called feet.
Architecture that embodies this element of the classical tradition would be an architecture that is attuned to us as human beings. We haven't physically, and I'm slightly inclined to think also mentally and psychologically, haven't changed all that much in the course of recorded and even unrecorded history of our species. We're amazingly stable in certain respects. And what I'm saying about that is that from an early time, theorists and architects, I think, have emphasized, rightly so, that architecture in the classical tradition would be attuned to the male and the female human body. That is to say, our dimensions, our proportions, those properties of our own shape, of our own dimensions, of our own stride, of our own arm's length, of our human foot, those are very, very important. And I think that those remain basic to an architecture which evokes in us these innermost aesthetic responses. And so an architecture like the orders that you've just spoken about, the Greek, the Ionic, and so forth, if you read a little further into the text, yes, they consist of this, that, that, and the other thing. But more than anything else, they are, according to the ancient theorists, based on the parts of our body. And so that's why in my website, somewhat anachronistically, people might say, I continue to emphasize all the measurements in feet. And that's the sense in which I think many of the texts that one tends to read about classicism all too often get bogged down in those details that we've just been speaking about. And as you say yourself, it's more than that. It's got to be more than that.
There's an important distinction implied here between what we generally refer to as classical architecture and what Pierre calls architecture in the classical tradition. The latter can even dispense with the formal trappings of classicism, the capitals and columns, and retain the soul of classicism, the fundamental concern with how our bodies interact with space.
I'm at variance with some of the people that have written, one of them being my early mentor, John Summerson, wrote a very interesting book. He said, yes, it was nonsense to say that a building that didn't have those attributes that you've talked about of the classical orders of architecture could be described as classicism. I disagree with that. I really do. I fundamentally think that's very, very restricted view of what classicism is all about, which is, again, not to say that a building that has those things doesn't partake of it. But I think it is possible for a very contemporary building, and all we need to do is look around us, and there are many, many of them that have absolutely none of the vestiges of the classical architectural tradition. The Museum of Civilization, for example, it's possible to go into Douglas Cardinal's building, and I think it's possible to say, yes, that's a contemporary building that partakes of certain of the aspects of the classical tradition, and there's not a column in the strict Greek or Roman sense anywhere to be seen in that building.
But hang on a minute. If we define the classical tradition this broadly, doesn't just about everything count as architecture in the classical tradition? Or at least, everything that reaches a certain threshold of thought and care in its design. Pierre acknowledges the risk involved in using so broad a definition, but says that when he created his website, Architecture in the Classical Tradition, he deliberately chose that risk rather than the alternative.
I felt instinctively, when I put together architecture in the classical tradition, that yes, I ran the risk of just what you say, calling just about anything and everything classical. But I thought that the other risk was worse. I thought that the risk of categorizing everything in ever smaller little silos, little bunches, to say, well, this is separate from that and that's separate from that, really was only good up to a certain point. And it led the listener, the student, the potential lover of architecture down the wrong path, where they said, gee, I don't know whether I should like that or not, because I don't know whether that's flamboyant or perpendicular Gothic. Do I dare weigh in on that? I'm not quite sure chronologically. And if I say that for England, does that apply to France? And what am I going to say about the Houses of Parliament in Ottawa? And so on and so forth, you know? And we get bogged down, or we can get bogged down, in all of these little subcategories. And on it goes. And everybody's got a different bunch of them. And I fall, to some extent, of course, also into that trap, because I had to, talking about chronology after all, I mean, there was a, you know, there is a march of time, and I had to line things up in a certain way. But I tried as much as possible to get away from the categorization and always hone in on the fact that, yes, this looks different from that, I agree with you, but look at the things that are common to both. And surely that's more important. I don't say, gosh, I like architecture up to, you know, let's say the birth of Pugin, and after that I just write it off because it becomes Gothic Revival and I detest that stuff, you know? And people do, or used to do that kind of thing all the time. Or, you know, Christopher Wren is bunk, or whatever it might be, and make these hard and fast judgments. They cut themselves off from all kinds of structures. And we, you know, in our own time, realize as we look back over the historiography of the last 50 years in architectural history, it's come a long way. It's changed a lot. And we see that there were some fallacious ideas out there, and people saying, you know, you do not want to look at this, because not only is this not classical, this is just rubbish, you know? And I resist that. I try to resist that at the risk of maybe being a bit, you know, too all-inclusive.
As you can tell, Pierre Dupré cares deeply about architecture, about how it affects us, and about what it can contribute to our lives. And he believes we should all care, because if we don't, we end up saddled with a lot of bad architecture. We owe it to ourselves and to each other to understand and fight for the enduring principles that create an architecture that uplifts us, that contributes to our quality of life.
The fact that we have as much poor architecture, architecture not well suited to ourselves, our beings, our proportions, our bodies, the reason that happens as much as it does is that people haven't been attuned to that and aren't demanding it. Informed opinion is so important. It's unfortunately all too easy to crush it out of people because the whole forum of public debate is very fraught. It's very emotionally draining, psychologically draining, the battles of will and points of view and so on. And yet, one has to encourage, especially the young, to go in with their hip boots and get into it, get into the fray, and at least for a few years in a hurry, fight the good fight, because otherwise we have only ourselves to blame for living in a planet that's, you know, cities, and I don't just mean cities, but countryside too, that's increasingly uninhabitable. You don't want to be there. And we're stuck with it. We have nowhere else to go.
The fight is hard, but some things are worth fighting for. And architecture is one of those things. Architecture really matters.
Hey, it's important for us. It does something for us. It elevates our spirits. And we want it, and we have a right to ask for it. But if you don't ask for it, and you don't feel it, and you don't want it, and wanting it is a lot of it, if you don't feel it, and you're not emotionally driven to having it, then you're missing out on a lot. You're missing out on what buildings can do for you. And I don't just mean, you know, protect you from the elements, but I mean really something for you at a deep, almost spiritual level. They can sing, and that's what I like to see a lot more of.
I guess you could say that for Pierre Dupré, architecture in the classical tradition is a lifelong project of the human race, a project to create an architecture that responds not just to our need for shelter, but also to our desire for beauty, and to our body's instinctive need to interact comfortably and intelligibly with our environment. Now I think it's time for me to take a walk. A walk down my street, through my neighborhood, and see how much of the built environment in my community rises to that challenge, and how much falls short. This HTA podcast was produced by me, Peter Kaufman. My guest was Professor Pierre Dupré.